Hello and welcome to the podcast the internet deserves, but not the one it needs right now. And so we'll keep talking. Because we can record it. Because we're not heroes. We're silent guardians. Watchful protectors. This is Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me as always is a man who lived long enough to see himself become the villain.
Mike DiCrescio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I thought you were going to make a reference about my birth name is Robin, but that one works too. Either one works.
I was waiting for you to make the reveal that your birth name was actually Robin.
Oh, man. If only we coordinated on these jokes.
Yeah, oh, man. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, we never coordinate on the jokes. That's what gives us our fresh take on all the things that we do today. But usually we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions, and then we conclude with our featured review. This week we're reviewing the new film from director Christopher Nolan, obviously. It's Dunkirk. Mike, are you excited to dig into Dunkirk?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm very interested with what you have to say.
Yeah, I'm eager to talk about it. I'm jealous of you. You saw it in a 70mm IMAX.
Actually, it turns out, just 70mm, no IMAX for
me. Okay, but still, 70mm is
still pretty dope.
Pretty cool. So that's cool. I had to see it on a regular theater screen. I might as well not even watched it.
Yeah. You sat facing the wall.
I might as well have watched it on my phone through a plastic paper bag or whatever.
wait, what?
Or through a plastic bag, I mean. A plastic bag lined with paper, Mike. Keep up.
Okay, sure. Stay tuned for more dank jokes, everybody.
I might as well have rubbed mud in my eyes while I watched Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk because I didn't experience the majesty of 70mm. But you know what? I powered through, and the movie is what it is, and I am eager to talk about it. Also, speaking of, you should really listen to this podcast in 70mm. however it is, if you can like rent out a 70mm theater and just use their speakers, like that would be the way to do it, I think.
That seems reasonable to request.
Yeah, I think so. So we'll pause. We'll let you do that. While we wait for you to get around to that, let's get into some film news. It's film news here on Film Bookcast. Mike here is what we got going on in film news today. San Diego Comic-Con was this past week. Crazy stuff happening out of there. A lot of stuff happening, mostly out of the Marvel panel, as is always the case.
Yeah.
Whenever Marvel brings it. Like, there were other panels happening. There was other cool stuff happening there. But mostly people are there from Marvel, and they always bring it. And there's a lot of stuff happening. I wanted to run down a few of the bigger stories that came out of Comic-Con. The first, this wasn't part of the Marvel panel proper, but this is part of the Legion panel. Noah Hawley was the creator of Legion, also the creator of the Fargo TV series, revealed at the end of the panel that he is developing a Doctor Doom movie for 20th Century Fox. That is pretty insane, Mike.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about the deep backstory of Doctor Doom, but if there's anyone I trust to make a weird, psychedelic, trippy movie that blows my mind, it's going to be Noah Hawley.
Yeah, I mean, you haven't watched Legion yet, right?
No,
okay,
well, but that's what I've heard.
Yeah, I mean, Legion is incredible, and it's one of the most unique superhero things that has ever existed. It's pretty great, and I really hope that whatever this movie is, it's like a tenth as insane and imaginative as Legion is, because Legion, again, is just so good. Just give him everything. Give Noah Hawley everything.
Yeah.
And a Doctor Doom movie is intriguing, because Doctor Doom is traditionally a big Marvel villain, specifically towards the Fantastic Four. He's kind of their biggest foe.
Right.
And it seems like they want to avoid the Fantastic Four this time around because they do not seem to be able to get that one right.
Yeah, so we'll just make a villain movie about it.
Just make Doctor Doom. So I think if anybody can do a good job with that, it's Noah Hawley. It is kind of a bummer to me that Doctor Doom is kind of tied up at 20th Century Fox just because he is like one of the biggest and best Marvel villains that Marvel Comics has at their disposal.
Right.
And I would really love the Marvel Cinematic Universe to be able to access Doctor Doom, specifically once all the Infinity War stuff is done. I don't know how many big villains they have to kind of take the place that Thanos takes. Like, if they're going to do another thing where they build up to like this big crazy movie for like 10 years in the same way they've been doing with Infinity War, I don't know what villain could, you know, take that throne.
The Green Goblin.
Maybe, you know. No. I actually feel like Norman Osborn could be a pretty great villain for them to use in that regard, but I don't think it could just be him, you know. And even if it's if it is Norman Osborn, I think it would be very difficult to get the you know, the Spacebound heroes in on this big crossover adventure. Supposedly, we're talking about a movie. We're talking about a hypothetical movie, like 15 years from now. But but I'm saying if they need like a successor to Thanos in terms of like who could be the biggest bad that Marvel has at their disposal, I feel like Doctor Doom is that guy.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a bummer to me that the Marvel Cinematic Universe does not have access to Doctor Doom. But if 20th Century Fox is going to do their thing and make a Doctor Doom movie, then Noah Hawley is a guy I trust to make it. So definitely pretty excited about that. And now let's talk about some stuff that happened at the Marvel panel. Basically, they brought it. You know, they brought a whole bunch of stuff. They had new footage from Black Panther, new footage from Avengers Infinity War. None of that is online. That was specifically for the crowd at Comic-Con. They did show a new trailer for Thor Ragnarok and put that online. I don't know if you saw that trailer, Mike. It looks like the best movie ever made. it looks incredible. I mean, it just looks bananas. I trust Taika Waititi completely with this thing. I think he's really put his own stamp on Thor and the Marvel Universe in general, and it's really funny, and it's really goofy, and it just looks insane. There is a shot in that trailer of Thor and Loki standing side by side shooting laser machine guns, and it was the happiest it's ever been in my entire life watching that.
It's the thing you always needed but never knew.
Exactly. It's pretty great. It's pretty great. But there were a couple of news morsels that were thrown out there at the Marvel panel. They talked about Ant-Man and the Wasp. Peyton Reed was there, and he announced that Michelle Pfeiffer has been cast as the original Wasp in Ant-Man and the Wasp. So if you remember in Ant-Man, the Wasp's disappearance was part of the plot of that movie. Michael Janet Van Dyne, I think, is her name. And so, you know, supposedly she's in the quantum realm or whatever. But now Michelle Pfeiffer has been cast to play her in the sequel. So that's pretty cool. I assume this movie will probably be like a Search for the Wasp kind of thing, like a Search for Spock-esque thing. Or she'll pop up in the first 20 minutes and just be on the adventure. Who knows? But
it'll be young Michelle Pfeiffer because Marvel loves doing that.
Yeah, well, I think it would be. I mean, I am sure there will be some kind of flashback scene where it will be young Michelle Pfeiffer and it will blow everyone away. to be fair, like Marvel is really excellent at that young actor stuff. Like it's actually incredible, I think. And it's different than like the stuff with like Rogue One and Grand Moff Tarkin like took me out of the movie because it just looks weird to me. But when Marvel does it, like because they have the actors actually there and they're just using CGI to de-age them. Like whatever technique they're using, it is working. It really blows me away. Like that was young Michael Douglas in the flashback of Ant-Man. Like I remember it looked like he walked off the set of Romancing the Stone and it was pretty nuts.
Straight into that.
Straight into that scene. So pretty stoked about Michelle Pfeiffer's casting. That's pretty cool. Apparently that's the actress that Evangeline Lilly wanted for the role. So that's pretty cool. I know Michael Douglas was actually jonesing for his wife to get the role, Catherine Zeta-Jones. And that would have been cool too, but Michelle Pfeiffer is great, and that's crossing the DC and Marvel streams. You know, she played Catwoman in Batman Returns. So that's cool. Actually, Lawrence Fishburne is also in Ant-Man and the Wasp, which also crosses the DC Marvel streams because he's in the new DC movies as Perry White. So there's that as well. And then another piece of Marvel news. Captain Marvel will be taking place in the 90s, as it turns out. So it's going to be like a prequel sort of origin story about Captain Marvel. And it's going to have Samuel Jackson in the movie as Nick Fury, which we talked about last week. And he's going to have two eyes in this movie because because it's the 90s. It's the past. So maybe we'll see.
Big change.
Maybe we'll see how he loses his eye. Who knows? I don't really care about that. But but still kind of cool. And this movie will have her battling Skrulls. And that is actually kind of significant, Mike. I don't know if you're aware of what Skrulls are.
Yes, I'm aware that they're like a very classic Marvel villain. They're like shapeshifter guys, I think, right?
They're pretty like one. They're a pretty prominent alien race in the Marvel universe in the comics. And there was rumors going around when the first Avengers was being made that the aliens in that movie were going to be Skrulls, and they ended up being the Chitauri. And at the time, the reason for that was because nobody really knew who had the rights to the Skrulls. So there was a lot of legal confusion about who could use Skrulls. Nobody has used Skrulls in a movie up to this point. But because the Skrulls, I think, are often, they're a foe for the Avengers, but they're also a foe for the Fantastic Four. And so it was a weird gray area where no one was really sure if they could use Skrulls, but they didn't want to step on anybody's toes and use them, you know? So now it seems like Marvel is taking claim to the Skrulls, which is something. So in terms of the minutia of nerddom, I think that's kind of a significant
I also think it's pretty cool. I have read some Deadpool comics where he fights the Skrull, and they're really goofy. I mean, that may be virtue of the fact that it was a Deadpool book.
That's quite possible.
But I think that is exciting for the tone of Captain Marvel to just be like a silly action movie.
I have hopes for Captain Marvel, so that's pretty cool. And Brie Larson, I mean, I'm very excited to see what she does with that role because I love Brie Larson. So that'll be cool. And then finally, I have the most important story that has to do with the superhero movie. Henry Cavill's mustache, Mike.
You son of a bitch. Who let you pick the stories this week?
Me, and I do that every week. But
people don't need to know, Mike.
Yes. Yeah, so if you haven't heard, the new Justice League movie is coming out in November. It's currently undergoing reshoots, and apparently what happened is that Henry Cavill did not have a mustache when he was filming the movie the first time, and Superman doesn't have a mustache to begin with anyway, in most traditional incarnations of Superman. And then the movie wrapped filming, and then he went to go work on Mission Impossible 6, where he's a cast member in that movie, and he grew a mustache for the role. And then he had to go back for reshoots on Justice League, but I guess he was shooting Mission Impossible 6 at the same time, and there was a contract dispute where I think Paramount would not let Warner Brothers let him shave his mustache.
Jesus Christ.
It's a very sordid state of affairs over there. So now Henry Cavill's mustache is prominently featured on several of the shots in the reshoots, and Warner Brothers actually has to digitally remove his mustache from Justice League. And as soon as that news broke out, my entire Twitter timeline just went bananas.
Everyone just exploded.
It freaked out. Because I think it's a kind of emblematic of DC's problem. What's happening with DC movies is that every conceivable problem gets thrown in their way. You know? This is going to be a super expensive procedure, I'm pretty sure. Like, they're going to have to pay, like, probably millions of dollars to have somebody digitally remove Henry Cavill's mustache.
Frame by frame to take out a mustache.
Exactly. And a lot of people are saying, like, you know, Henry Cavill's pretty attractive with a mustache. Why don't you take that money and digitally add a mustache to the scenes where he doesn't have one? That would be – that might be a better
use. What's the twist?
Could be wild. Because who knows? Like, there could be a version of Superman with a mustache. That could be the new interpretation of Superman. Like, he's back from the dead and he's got a mustache.
Got a motherfucking mustache.
I would be into it. I think that would be a pretty cool – new take on Superman, but alas, that is not to be. WB is removing the mustache. Hopefully, they will release a mustache cut of the movie.
On the director's cut Blu-ray. It'll have the mustache left in.
Exactly. So hopefully that's the case. But yeah, otherwise, and that, they did screen some footage of Justice League at Comic-Con. I think that went online, actually.
Yeah, there's like a 5-minute trailer or something.
That's the thing. So I didn't watch it because it was 5 minutes long. So I was like, I'm not going to bother. Like, it's coming out in a couple months. I'm sure I'll see more trailers for it in the future. I'm not going to watch a 5-minute trailer for this movie because DC already has a habit of revealing way too much in their trailers as it is.
Yeah, it's got to be the whole movie. So, yeah,
so I'm not going to do that. But anyway, yes, so that's all the superhero stuff I wanted to get through today. And then I also wanted to briefly mention the reveal of the new Doctor Who, Mike. This is kind of a big deal, even though neither of us watched Doctor Who. So under normal circumstances, I probably wouldn't even bring it up. Like, it was just a new Doctor Who, whatever. But this is kind of a big deal because it is the first female Doctor Who that we're getting this time. It's Jodie Whittaker from Attack the Block. And Jodie Whittaker, again, is awesome in Attack the Block. Have you seen Attack the Block, Mike?
Yes. Okay, yeah, she's great in that.
She's great in that movie. She's also – she was in an episode of Black Mirror in season one, the episode where they are they can rewatch their memories through, like, a thing in their eyes. She was in that episode, and she was good in that too. And I guess she's on the TV show Broadchurch, which airs in Britain, and supposedly it's a pretty good show. She's pretty good on it. But yeah, so this is kind of a big deal, because Doctor Who has traditionally been a male character, and people have been saying for a long time, like, that Doctor Who could be a female character. And, you know, I feel like we always look at these iconic characters who get recast in movies and TV shows all the time, and it's always a dude, and people are like, well, what if it was a woman this time? Like, with James Bond, Right. That's the thing that people talk about. And so I think it's kind of cool that, you know, BBC put their money where their mouth is and, you know, did a female Doctor Who. And this is a character that works perfectly for it because it regenerates as, like, you know, a different being every couple of years or whatever, whenever right. an actor needs to change. So I think it's pretty cool. So I wanted to briefly mention that. I don't know if you have any other thoughts about that other than that's cool. But
Yeah, I mean, like you said, neither of us watch Doctor Who, but I am very proud or happy that they've done this, that BBC is going to fucking do it. And hopefully they do it right and don't make it, like, a joke throughout the series. Because if they do, that will just undermine and undercut the whole gesture. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I guess. But definitely cool. So that's something that I wanted to just bring up. I was thinking about it earlier today. I've only ever seen, like, maybe 20 seconds of assorted Doctor Who footage. And,
wow.
And the reason for that is because a while back for this podcast, we were doing different spoiler bumpers every time. until I finally settled on the Game of Thrones one that we use later on, that we'll use later on in the episode. And we've been using that for, like, probably over a year now. But early on in the podcast, I was using different ones every time. And there was one time where I was just, like, scrounging YouTube looking for a new spoiler bumper. And I found like, a clip of Doctor Who, like a montage of clips of Doctor Who, where I guess there was a character on that show where a main character had a catchphrase, and the catchphrase was spoilers. So I watched that video and, like, used it as a clip once. And so I've seen, like an assorted 30 seconds of Doctor Who scattered across, you know, probably
nice.
Probably several years of the show.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen episodes of it. I was going to watch it. I was going to watch the modern Doctor Who stuff. And I watched maybe six or seven of the Christopher Eccleston series. And it was good. Like, it's silly. It's fun. It's sci-fi. But it just didn't grab me to keep watching.
Yeah, it's never seen, like, it always just seemed like something that I'm like, ah, like, that seems like a huge cultural thing, but also, like, I don't know. So, yeah, that's the Jodie Whittaker Doctor Who news. Pretty cool. And then we do have a bunch of other stuff to get through in film news, Mike, so we should try to get through this as quickly as possible, but we're not going to.
So let's be real.
Let's be realistic about this. The Emmy nominations came out, Mike. They happened a little while ago, but we should talk about them briefly anyway. So I wanted to talk about just kind of the major awards, see what your thoughts are on the nominations, because I have some concerns. But maybe concerns is too strong a word. I don't care that much, but, like, I'm a little annoyed about some of this.
All right, sure.
So for Outstanding Comedy Series, you've got Atlanta, which is great, Black-ish, Master of None, Modern Family, Silicon Valley, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and Veep. And I'm cool with pretty much all of those except Modern Family, which I cannot believe is still in the Emmy death grip. That's
give it its 10th Emmy, Mike, or whatever it's up to.
I mean, it won, like, 5 years in a row, and then it lost, I think, the last 2 years to Veep. And, you know, Veep is a great show as well, and I'm happy. I was pretty happy that Veep won last year, because I think it had its best season last year, season 5. Those are the comedy nominees. And then the drama nominees, we have Better Call Saul, The Crown, The Handmaid's Tale, House of Cards, Stranger Things, This Is Us, and Westworld. Now, can you tell the part of the best drama series bit that I take issue with, Mike?
I'm pretty sure it was the Better Call Saul that you're grumpy with.
No, that is the opposite of what I'm talking about. I think it's ridiculous that Stranger Things is nominated in this category. I know it was your favorite show of last year, so I'm sure you're happy about it.
But like you said, like, who cares? Whatever.
Yeah, no, obviously, like, who cares? But I think it is odd. And Stranger Things got a lot of nominations. I mean, like,
really?
A lot. Including a couple of acting awards. David Harbour was nominated for supporting actor, which I can see. That's fine.
Yeah, he was really
good. He was good. He was good, sure. Millie Bobby Brown was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, which I think is absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, like, I know everybody is obsessed with Eleven. That's, like, a thing. And I saw Millie Bobby Brown at Comic-Con. I saw their panel, and she was great at the panel. Like, she's really charismatic and stuff. But I think her performance as Eleven is just her staring at things, and that's not, like, that to me.
But, like, she can move stuff with her mind.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the character can. She physically cannot do that. The actress can.
Fine, you know.
If the actress herself, if Millie Bobby Brown could move stuff with her mind, then I'd be like, all right, give her an Emmy nomination. But
that's how method she is.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting. I mean, it's a thing that I haven't really paid attention to in the last few years, but that drama category, it's like, it was like one or two traditional TV shows and the rest are all streaming. We're streaming series.
Yes, actually, you're right. I mean, there's, one AMC, Better Call Saul, one NBC, This Is Us, and one HBO, Westworld. There's three Netflixes and one Hulu in here.
Yeah.
Which is pretty nuts. And, yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing. See, I feel like, here's the thing. Game of Thrones won this award the last 2 years. And Game of Thrones was not eligible to be part of the Emmys this year because it was outside of the eligibility ranking.
Pushed it back.
Yeah, because the season came out later. So the show has to air sometime between June 1st and May 31st, like in that year span.
Right.
So May 31st, 2017 was the cutoff. And so Game of Thrones didn't make it in this year. That's also why Twin Peaks is not nominated, by the way. Just throwing that out there. next year, if Twin Peaks does not clean up at the fucking Emmys...
then they're worthless.
They are absolutely worthless. But yeah, so I wanted to bring that up because I think it's anybody's game, I think, at this point. Who could win these Emmys for outstanding drama series? Out of these shows, I would love to see it go to Better Call Saul. The only ones that I've watched out of these seven shows that are nominated, I've only watched three of them, which are Better Call Saul, Stranger Things, and Westworld. But I would love to see Better Call Saul take it. Westworld, I'd be okay with too. I think Stranger Things might have a shot at this just because of the massive popularity that show has.
Yeah, just culturally, it seems like it'll win.
Yeah, although The Handmaid's Tale could win just because of like the time period that this is right now. I feel like that's like a pretty heavy political statement if you gave it to The Handmaid's Tale, so they might do that. This Is Us is also a huge hit that I talk. I hear people talk about This Is Us all the time. Like in my real life, like it's like not just on my internet life where like the real good shows are, but like in my real life, people are like, "Hey, have you watched This Is Us?" And I'm like, "Nah," but
I'm above all that.
I'm above all your peasant network television. I'm not. I watch a ton of network television, but but I have not watched This Is Us. So I wanted to mention those, and then a couple other ones: outstanding limited series, Big Little Lies, Fargo, Feud, Genius, and The Night of. Out of those, I've only watched Fargo and The Night Of. And, you know, both of those shows are good, so we'll see what happens there. I did want to say, it is an absolute travesty that The Leftovers is not nominated for really anything in these Emmy nominations.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of insane. Carrie Coon is nominated for Fargo for Best Actress in a Limited Series. But that feels like I've been watching Fargo a little bit. Like, I've been making my way through it, season three, and it's good. I'm really enjoying it, but, like... she's nominated for the wrong show, you know. It's her performance in Leftovers is like legendary. I feel like it's going to be like it's insanely how good that performance is and how good everybody on that show is and how good that show was. Like that show should easily win the Outstanding Drama Series category, I think, and it's not nominated at all, and that is a shame. For sure.
Don't worry, the Stranger Things is in there though, Mike.
Exactly. Yeah. So fuck me, right? But but then there are a couple of other like, cool surprises. Pamela Adlon's nominated for Better Things, and I think that's pretty cool. Zach Galifianakis is nominated for Baskets, which I think is pretty cool. And Donald Glover is nominated for Atlanta. Black Mirror is nominated for Outstanding Television Movie San Junipero, the episode. So there's that. I was curious like if that counts as a television movie or if it's like an episode of a TV show, but Sherlock is also nominated in that category, so I guess it's whatever.
So just do whatever, BBC,
yeah.
I guess.
So there it is. But so wanted to bring those up, the Emmys, just kind of talking about some of the major nominees, and then we should move on to some other news, because again, we just have so much film news to get through. some controversial stories came out over the past couple of weeks, Mike. Some controversial new projects that are being made, and I wanted to get your take on them. The first of which is Quentin Tarantino's next movie. Now, I am very, very excited about this, solely because it's the next Quentin Tarantino movie. That's all.
Right.
That's honestly all I need to hear, and I'm like, I already, like, gave my ticket. I've already purchased my ticket. but his next movie will be about the Manson family murders, which is... kind of nuts. This is going to be the first time he's done a movie based on a true story, far as I know. He's done movies based around true events, like, you know, Inglourious Basterds and stuff like that, but obviously it's a fictionalized version of World War II. So this seems like it's going to be based on a real-life event, and that's really all we know about it right now, is that it is about the Manson family murders. We don't even know if it's, like, actually about it, or if it's using it as, like, a launching-off point or something like that. It may involve Sharon Tate in some capacity,
Right.
But I think that's really intriguing. There's been talk about Brad Pitt and Jennifer Lawrence circling this project, which I would love to see Brad Pitt work with Tarantino again, and I'd be really interested to see Jennifer Lawrence work with Quentin Tarantino. I think that could be a really interesting pairing. What was your take when you heard that Tarantino was doing a Charles Manson movie?
I'm definitely interested. I think, like you said, seeing him do a true story and a not cartoonish version of a true story, right? Like you said,
presumably, yeah. If that's
yeah,
what, yeah, because that's kind of the thing that people were getting upset about, is that they were kind of just judging this based on what they assume a Quentin Tarantino movie is, which is just, you know, insane, bloody, over the top violence and all that stuff, and that's not something you need to glorify in terms of the Manson family murders,
right?
But that's, I feel like that really has like a very dismissive and a misunderstanding of what Quentin Tarantino's movies actually are, because they're also like they have that violence a lot of the time, but they're also a commentary on that violence.
Right.
And also I doubt this movie will be like, you know, the fight with the crazy 88 and Kill Bill or something like that. Like it's not going to be like yeah. that.
Yeah. I also feel like I remember hearing Quentin Tarantino talk about how he was interested in doing a horror film in the future. And if he was going to do a creepy horror slasher thing around the Manson family murders, like that sounds really cool, but that's also just me hoping for stuff
speculating. Yeah
exactly. But that's, I'm interested, I'm definitely down, like you know, like you said, just by the fact that it's a Tarantino movie, I'm pretty much in. Yeah. And I'm eager to learn more.
Absolutely, yeah. So I wanted to bring that up. And then the other, I thought the Quentin Tarantino thing would be the most controversial story we talk about. And then I got an email from HBO, because I get HBO's press releases sent to my phone. I work at a radio station, so I get like, you know, press releases from different networks and stuff if I want to, like,
right.
if there's like people who are ready for interviews or something like that. So HBO sent a press release to my phone, and I opened it, and I read it. And my immediate thought was, this sounds pretty cool, not even thinking about what the reaction to this news was going to be. And then I checked Twitter, and it was a bloodbath. And
You done fucked up now, Mike.
Yeah. HBO has announced a new series called Confederate, which is a series that's going to be from the creators of Game of Thrones, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, or D.B. Weiss and David Benioff. I might have mixed those up. And it's basically about an alternate reality where the South successfully seceded from the Union in the Civil War, and slavery is still legal there. And it's, it takes place in the present day, but it's like an alternate present day where we're gearing up towards a third Civil War. I like that in the press release, they note the third Civil War, because it means yeah. we've already had a second one. It's already yep. happened. And, you know, they're talking about, like, people, it's following people on both sides of, like, the Mason-Dixon line. They call it something else, like the Mason-Dixon Battle Zone or something. And this news sparked just a huge wave of controversy. And I didn't even think about why it would be controversial until I saw it on Twitter. And I was like, oh, obviously, of course, this is controversial. Of course people yeah. are upset about this.
Why? How could you not realize that yeah. would happen?
Yeah, so that was dumb on my part, for sure. But anyway, yeah, so I don't know, because I've read a lot about this show. I've read a lot, and I've kind of resolved to just never read the comments on anything about this show ever again.
Sure.
just for my own sanity at this point.
That's a good mantra for the internet in general.
That's true, but specifically for this, and for actually Quentin Tarantino's Manson family movie, that was like
I can't believe that's controversial. I didn't hear it. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, no, if you read the comments about some of those articles, it would be...
That's fair.
But anyway, yeah, so I think people are upset about this, A, because its premise seems tone deaf in the current political climate that we live in now, and B, because they don't trust the creators of Game of Thrones to make a nuanced portrayal of race in America. And that was kind of the big – those are kind of the two big points. Mike, I mean, you were kind of on that side as well, right?
Yeah. On one hand, I'm very interested to see what this kind of story and this kind of tale could tell, right? You know, especially as art, as a mirror, and all those things, you know, to be able to examine our current state of the fucking world, particularly the U.S.,
yeah.
Through this lens. But also, maybe just, like, don't, because there's a lot of people that don't have to put what if in front of racism. There's yeah. so much going on that...
I think the tweet that most best encapsulated it for me, I forget who it was, but somebody tweeted that, man, I would like to see a show about an alternate reality where the South didn't win the Civil War. And that kind of put things into helped put things into perspective for me, at least. I'm still really intrigued by the show.
And I am worried, like, you know, I've been thinking about Game of Thrones and the way that around delicate matters, Game of Thrones has the subtlety of a sledgehammer. so, like, I'm not sure. You know, you can go into a story like this with the good intention, right? Capital G, capital I, of using it as a mirror, but also, like, you're going to have to show slavery as a good thing when you focus on characters that are those places.
I don't think they're going to have to show slavery as a good thing. That's not really what they're going to be going for, I don't think. They're going to be showing it as a frank thing, I think. And, I mean, again, the show is at least 2 years away because they're not going to start They're not going to start it until Game of Thrones is over. So we're at least seeing – we're at the earliest we're seeing this in 2019. But I think people – part of what got people so upset is that they thought it would be glorifying slavery. And I think that's the most boneheaded thing I've heard. I think it's ridiculous to assume that Dave Benioff and D.B. Weiss are going to create a show that is endorsing slavery. You know, that's not something I think they're setting out to do. Right. And I get the concern that because of the current environment and the current state of the world, that people might take the show as that anyway.
That's the big concern.
Yes.
I think.
So I think that is definitely a part of it. But on the creative side, though, I mean, they've hired people working on the show. The other executive producers of the show are both black, and they've made a lot of great TV shows in the past. Like, they've worked on Justified and The Good Wife and stuff like that, and they seem to be really talented. And on HBO's part, they actually addressed the controversy. As soon as the controversy hit, the writer, like Benioff and Weiss and the two writers they hired, I'm blanking on their names right now, or else I would say them. But they, you know, did an interview where they talked about the show and about, like, how they kind of expected some of the controversy and about what they're trying to do with the show and how some of the, like, you know, so it kind of put some of the fears to rest a little bit there. But also HBO kind of talked about it, I think today or yesterday. The Television Critics Association has been happening this week, so there's been a lot of, like, panels and press going on for the TCAs, and HBO was there, and they talked about Confederate, and the president of HBO was saying that if he had to do it over again, they definitely screwed up the press. Like, they screwed up announcing the show because they shouldn't have done it in a press release where it just could, you know, catch on like wildfire like that, and like people would misread it and misinterpret it. But he still is backing the show on a creative standpoint, and I'm not sure if HBO like even fully comprehended the controversy that this would brew. I think their entire thought process for greenlighting the show was like, well, these two guys are behind the biggest show on television right now, so let's let them do whatever they want.
Yeah, exactly.
And apparently this is an idea they've been like developing for years. I guess they wanted to do it as a movie originally. And it's been kind of steadily growing. And I really love Game of Thrones, and I think they're good storytellers. So I'm still intrigued by the show, although I'm definitely wary about it. I still feel like there's something to this. And if they can successfully do this, like, and really do something that can, like, be really incisive and insightful and critical, and I think there is value in that if they can pull it off. I think the problem is if they don't pull it off, it could look really bad.
Yeah, that destroys them.
Yes.
If they don't pull that off. So it seems pretty high risk, high reward, I guess. We'll see what happens. But like you said, we're 2 years out. So hopefully they change things or I don't know, release more information to quell everyone's fears. Hopefully.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. In the meantime, we can just enjoy Game of Thrones because it's been dope this season, man.
It absolutely has.
It's been so good. Anyway, yeah, so I wanted to bring that up. And then finally, I have one last bit of film news. And this,
Mother of God.
This is some very sad news, of course. RIP George Romero and Martin Landau. Romero, I mean, hugely influential horror director, somebody who's Night of the Living Dead is a movie I saw when I was like 11, maybe like 10 or 11. Like, that was a really early movie for me, and you know, I remember like being scared but like really digging it, and like, just so that was a pretty influential horror movie for me. And I mean, just like, he single-handedly basically created zombies, like the entire zombie boom that we have today. You know, we wouldn't have The Walking Dead, we wouldn't have you know, any of the subversive zombie stuff that we have. Edgar Wright would not have a career if George Romero didn't exist. You know, like Night of the Living Dead, you know, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead were all like just huge movies. And then, you know, his other horror stuff, The Crazies and Creep Show, and he has so much stuff. And like, he was such a huge director, and he was like such a good guy. You know, he seemed like the nicest guy. You know, I saw a picture of him with Sam Raimi in 1982 at the Cannes Film Festival. And wow. Sam Raimi looks like he's 5 years old. Like he's seriously, this was like a year. This was like a year after Evil Dead came out. Sam Raimi made Evil Dead when he was like 20. So he looks like he's a few years younger than we are. And it's just like this horror giant and like this awestruck kid standing next to George Romero. It's kind of nuts to see that picture. So that is pretty cool. And yeah, so RIP George Romero, like all that stuff, like all the zombie stuff today just is so popular because of what he did in that movement. So wanted to
change
bring up
horror.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Martin Landau as well died that I think that same day. Like it was a couple hours later that news came out.
Wow.
And Landau's a great actor. He was in North by Northwest, Tucker the Man in His Dream, Crimes and Misdemeanors. But for me, he won an Oscar for this role. It's one of my absolute favorite movies, Tim Burton's Ed Wood, in which he plays Bela Lugosi in that movie. And he is incredible in that movie. I used to quote, pull the string over and over again. And I remember earlier this year, we
just to no one in particular,
just to myself sitting alone in my room. It's fine. but like earlier this year, we went to go see the Mystery Science Theater thing at the Alamo Drafthouse with Frank Conniff and Trace Bellew. And when we were there, they showed Glenn or Glenda, which is a movie that they show the making of in Ed Wood. And I got to see the original Bela Lugosi say, pull the string on the big screen. And that was a pretty wild experience to be so familiar with Bela Lugosi's version and then with Martin Landau's version. And then to see Bela Lugosi say it was like, whoa, that's crazy. I wanted to bring both those up. Mike, did you have any like other thoughts about Romero or Landau, or should we move on?
No, I think it's the loss of two pretty big film icons, you know, that had 60-year careers, right?
Yeah, they were both fairly
very
old.
Prolific.
Yeah.
But afraid to say the new normal, I think. I think we're going to start losing a lot of people, unfortunately, so brace yourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's already kind of been the case. But I think we talked about this before, just the way that culture has worked over the last 50 years. We've gotten so many more options so many more avenues for artists to create. And that means there's so much more stuff out there that we've been raised on. And that means eventually like all those people will die and there's going to be it's going to be like every day, like at a certain point.
Yeah.
So that's a bummer. Actually earlier today, June Foray died, a prolific voice actress and a voice of I was obsessed with Rocky and Bullwinkle as a kid. I don't know if you know that. But I have,
that's the most you thing you've ever said.
But when I was like 8 or 9 years old, I have the DVDs of the first like 3 seasons of Rocky and Bullwinkle. And June Foray,
that's awesome.
June Foray's like probably most well-known role is as Rocky the Squirrel in Rocky and Bullwinkle. And she died today. She was 99 years old, which is kind of insane. And she was still working. Like she still did stuff. And you know, she's been a part of basically everything. She was Cindy Lou Who in How the Grinch Stole Christmas cartoon. She was a bunch of Looney Tunes characters. I believe she was the grandma in the Sylvester and Tweety cartoons, but she was also the witch. Hazel,
yes.
Which also it's another thing I quoted all the time when I was a kid. The Hansel and Gretel Looney Tunes cartoon. Do you remember that one? It's like the witch.
Oh man, I don't think I do.
There's a cartoon where it's like a Hansel and Gretel parody, and it's the witch trying to cook Hansel and Gretel. But there's a recurring
and her name
bit.
Is Hazel. That's amazing.
Well, the witch's name was Hazel, yeah, but that's not the joke. There's a recurring bit, and Bugs Bunny is there too, where they're just like. So confused by the character being named Hansel. Like every time he introduces himself, he's like, this is my sister Greta. And my name is Hansel. And every time he says it, every character just like takes a step back and like ponders and like Hansel, Hansel, Hansel. And, for some reason,
that's amazing.
Really hard when I was a kid. RIP. So RIP June Foray as well. I wanted to throw that in there, because she's a voice that has been, pretty much part of everyone's childhood since the 50s. It's kind of insane. So I wanted to throw that in one last time. And Mike, we got to move on. Like we've been through, we've probably spent like 40 minutes on these film news. So we should move on.
I have 10 more minutes though on Marvel news, Mike. Hold on.
We got to spend some detailed time going over Henry Cavill's mustache, but we can save that for the after show. Right now, we got to move on into some discussions. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions. All right, and now it's time for discussions on Film Bookcast. And just like film news, we got a shitload of discussions to get through. So so we should try to get through them as quickly as possible. Mike, why don't you start?
Sure. I have a few things to get through. First one is Red Sonja. I'm still working my way through my my list of 80s fantasy sci-fi schlock movies.
Yeah.
This is the third and final movie in the original Conan run. I know they have remade Conan, I think.
Right, with Jason Momoa.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, happens. That was a thing that existed.
And that was a thing that happened, yeah. The big deal, so Red Sonja, she's played by Brigitte Nielsen in her first film role.
Really?
Probably should have passed on it. The Red Sonja, as compared to the first two movies, is pretty rough.
Yeah.
The acting of Brigitte Nielsen is pretty wooden, because, you know, it just is what it is.
Sure.
But we do have Arnold returning as Kalidor?
So he's not playing Conan in this movie?
I mean, it's Conan, but he just, like, calls himself Kalidor, and, there's never even, like, a wink to the camera that he's Conan. Like, he just never acknowledges it.
Okay,
weird. He just is, it's just got a different name. That's weird.
Yeah.
Is he,
like, a significant part of the movie, or is he just, like, a cameo?
Significant in that he plays an important role, but he's not in much of the movie.
Okay, got it.
So it's a greater, it's a supporting role, basically.
Gotcha.
It also features Sandahl Bergman, who plays the evil queen in this movie, who was Valyria in Conan the Barbarian, Conan's love interest. She returns as a different character also.
That's cool. So this is basically like an alt-universe Conan movie.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It's really weird. There's some really funny stuff going on where there's a big sword fight at the end between Sonja and the evil queen, whose name I didn't write down, the character. But Sandahl Bergman was a stunt woman, so she is just like sword fighting circles around Brigitte Nielsen. It's like absolutely hilarious to watch the difference between as like, you know, Red Sonja is winning the sword fight like just because she has to. But the big deal about Red Sonja is the score is by Ennio Morricone.
Really?
So yeah, the other ones had kind of silly fantasy movie soundtracks, right? Scores.
Yeah.
And this has like a sweeping Ennio Morricone score.
That's pretty cool.
Like it's worth it just to watch the opening credits where it's just Red Sonja riding her horse on the steps as it's like the classic Ennio Morricone thing with riding your horse across the plains with the I expected them to do the Blazing Saddles joke where you ride past the orchestra. So that's Red Sonja. I took this burden on so you don't have to, basically. My next movie is Split Second, which is a 1992 action horror movie starring Rucker Hauer, Alistair Duncan, and Kim Cattrall. It also features Pete Postlewaite in, like, the most hilarious role I've ever seen him in. Yeah, and this is a silly, over-the-top, grim, dark kind of the global warming ravaged future of 2008. London is flooded. Rucker Hauer is a cop with nothing left to lose. His partner died and he blames himself. And he's got this whole shtick where he, you know, the captain says that he runs on coffee, cigars, and chocolate. And like to the point where he's brushing his teeth and he rinses the toothpaste out with coffee. Like just that kind of silliness.
Yeah.
And this is basically a movie that they would show at the Hudson Horror Show that we went to a couple months ago.
Right.
It did remind me a lot of The Hidden. Like, it's that kind of sci-fi. Yeah. It's a murder mystery. It starts out, turns it into, like, a creature feature type thing. Big monster. there's also a scene where Rucker Hauer goes to a bar where they have the bouncer has a giant dog, a guard dog with him, and he shows the dog his badge and he says "Police, dickhead" to the dog. Like, it's so dumb, but like in the best way. There's an amazing one take scene where they are they have finally seen the creature and they realize they keep making the "we need bigger guns" joke, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they go to the police armory and there's this really long one take where the new partner, who has been the like Oxford very stiff psychiatrist or, you know, serial killer profiler type character. And he, as soon as he sees the creature, he becomes Rutger Hauer's character, where he's drinking coffee and he's smoking cigarettes, and like he immediately dives into this. And the long take is them searching for the biggest gun they have while he's explaining all of the occult shit that he's now putting the pieces together.
Yeah.
And it's really manic and all over the place. And they wind up with an assault shotgun that can shoot 650 rounds a minute. Like, it's a minigun shotgun, and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
So if you can find Split Second, I did see it's on DVD and Blu-ray on Amazon. So check it out. Yeah. It's weird. It's wild.
It sounds awesome.
And the very last thing I have is I am halfway through The Keepers on Netflix, which is a documentary about a all-girls Catholic school outside of Baltimore, I think it is. One of the nuns that was a teacher there went missing and then was found murdered in, like, 1969. And the students at the school never gave up. They were never satisfied. The police and the FBI and like the case never went anywhere. The investigation was left open, and they kind of like at home detective this cold case with a bunch of journalists and the documentary filmmakers, and they get into some crazy shit. They uncover really wild accusations and allegations of cover ups. And there's a really crazy thing about, like, repressed trauma and like group memory, and about how all these students at the school, like, no one really remembered this thing until they were all together, and like they all kind of started talking about it and they like bring up these memories, and it's really interesting, but it is really heavy. So if you're at all, you know, I don't want to be like make a shitty trigger joke, but like there's definitely a trigger warning on this show, so if you're okay with that, check it out. It's really interesting.
All right, cool. That's The Keepers.
So those are my discussions.
All right, that's The Keepers on Netflix. And then I've got a bunch of stuff to get through. Obviously, I've got to talk about Twin Peaks, because this is my Twin Peaks discussion thread. Episodes 10 and 11 have aired since we last spoke. And Mike, you haven't watched the most recent episodes, right?
Correct. I'm still on episode 8.
Okay, yeah. So I won't go into the specifics of what's going on in these episodes, but it continues to be great. It arguably improves every week. There is just so much incredible stuff in these last few things. I am hypnotized by the show. I honestly think it might be the best thing Dave Lynch has ever done, this renewed season of Twin Peaks. And David Ehrlich wrote a great article about how David Lynch's increased role on the show in front of the camera as Gordon Cole has kind of been an influence on the show as a whole. And it's really interesting. I recommend checking that out. But there's just so much stuff happening. There is horrifying shit in these last two episodes, and there is hilarious shit. You know, oftentimes it's the same thing. It is really just bold and wild and experimental and weird, and it is everything I loved about the original Twin Peaks, but like just filtered directly through David Lynch without any network oversight on that show. You know, and it just feels so unique and so interesting, and like I really want you to catch up so that we can really talk about the last couple episodes specifically. I mean, there is some great stuff involving some classic characters in the most recent episode, but not in the way that you would expect, and it's just really really cool.
It did seem like, you know, episode 8 is the crazy experimental whatever David Lynch thing, and it did feel like this kind of, I mean, maybe you'll probably know more. It seems kind of like it's like a career ending thing, but it seems sort of not like in a bad way. I mean, like he's going to make this last 18 hour epic masterpiece and ride off into the sunset and never touch a camera again.
I do believe that's going to be the case. I mean, he hadn't like made any, like Inland Empire was probably going to be his last movie.
Right.
And that came out in 2006. Like it's been over 10 years since David Lynch has made anything. Save for like a couple of like oddball experiments here and there. Like he directed a Duran Duran concert that aired on YouTube, like live streamed, and like, you know, he's making like albums every once in a while, but like for the most part, like he's
doing art.
Yeah, exactly. But he hasn't made like a narrative feature in over 10 years. And so it's insane to see him back and just doing his shit and doing it better than anybody else ever could. He's changing the game again. And I do think this will probably be the last thing that he ever does. And so I'm savoring like every moment of this. Like it's just so, so good. So wanted to bring up Twin Peaks yet again, and I'll do it again next week. But I do have a bunch of movies to get through too. So I want to talk about those. I saw The Big Sick this past week, Mike. And this is the real life story of Kumail Nanjiani, a great comedian, and his wife, Emily Gordon. Now, you listen to a lot of podcasts, so I'm assuming you're familiar with Kumail and Emily Gordon.
Yes. Yeah. I know who they are.
Yeah. Anybody who listens to a couple of different podcasts has probably stumbled across their work at some point. Kumail Nanjiani plays himself in this movie, and this movie is directed by Michael Showalter, who is one of my favorite comedic actors. And I had not actually seen anything that he's ever directed before. I know you're a big fan of The Baxter, which I've been meaning to watch for a long time.
And I've
seen a lot of movies that he's written. You know, he wrote They Came Together, and he wrote What Had American Summer, and those are some of my favorite comedies. But I never actually seen any of the movies that he's directed. And this is also produced by Judd Apatow. And this is a really remarkable movie. I mean, it's really funny. It's not like an absurdist kind of thing that I usually expect from Showalter, though. It's more like a pretty straight comedy drama, but it's very funny, very emotional. Like if you're not familiar with the actual story behind this, because they've talked about this a lot on their podcast and stuff, Kumail Nanjiani and Emily were dating, and then Emily went into a coma right after they broke up, but then Kumail was taking care of her and all that stuff, and it kind of shows you that aspect of their relationship, but it also brings a fresh perspective that we don't see in movies that often. You know, Kumail is a Pakistani protagonist, but he's from a Pakistani family, but he was raised in America. And so it's also about the cultural differences between him and his family. And it's just really, really great. So this is a really great movie. It gives great roles to Holly Hunter and Ray Romano. They are incredible in this movie, especially I really liked the movie. But I think the thing I loved the most about it is that it gave Holly Hunter a great role, because I feel like I haven't seen her in a great role in a long time. Like I saw her in like Batman vs Superman. And like, that was it.
God. You know? Right.
You know, also, and this is totally superfluous, but it features maybe the best 9/11 joke of all time. so I wanted to throw that in there. If you're into super, it's not even like a morbid joke. It's just like placed as part of like an awkward conversation, and it's the best. But it's
amazing.
So it's really great. So The Big Sick, definitely check that out. And then I also saw Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
And you and 10 other people.
Yes. That is exactly right. This is the new balls out sci-fi movie from Luc Besson, director of The Professional, La Femme Nikita, Lucy with Scarlett Johansson. But more importantly for this, The Fifth Element. And this
movie, I thought you were going to say Lockout.
he was a producer on Lockout.
Oh, okay.
Which, by the way, Lockout, fucking great movie. Anyway, this movie is just wild, man. It is bonkers. This movie just packs the brim with insane shit. Do you remember the scene in Hellboy 2 where they go into the underground city, the secret city, and
so the Diagon Alley of Hellboy 2?
Yeah, exactly. Like the secret city, and you're just kind of like blown away by all the crazy fantasy creatures that are there, like in that like one sequence. Valerian is that for the entire movie. It is absurd. Visually, it is bonkers. And I think the movie is a lot of fun. I think it is way too – it's like 2 hours and 20 minutes, and I think it starts to feel like that after a while. But for the most part –
that's too many minutes.
Yeah, for the most part, I was really into it. Like, I wasn't really into it, but I was having a good time. And any movie that casts Rihanna as a shape-shifting alien stripper named Bubble and Ethan Hawke as her – Ethan Hawke plays her pimp, it's okay by me. You know, that's
That's amazing.
So I enjoyed Valerian, and Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne are pretty good too. The first thing I tweeted after I saw Valerian was that Dane DeHaan always looks like he didn't get enough sleep the night before filming. And I feel like
ever
just perpetually in every movie he's ever been in. But I feel like I really got that in Valerian. And I also kind of honed in on who he reminds me of, because he has like sort of a creepier Leonardo DiCaprio face. But he also has the voice of Keanu Reeves. And
wow.
And he's an actor I really like, Dane DeHaan. I'm a Dane DeHaan fan, but you know, I am. So I just think he's a really interesting actor who's doing like really, he has like a really odd presence in a lot of the movies. Also, just want to throw this out there. There is a straight up reference to another Luc Besson related movie, Taken, which I'm pretty sure I'm the only one in the theater who caught it, but it was pretty great. There's like a scene early on in the movie where Dane DeHaan is doing this like virtual gun thing, and the guy that he's holding up says to Dane DeHaan, like, one day, I will find you and I will kill you. And Dane DeHaan says, good luck. And it's,
oh, that's kind of awesome.
It was like, oh shit, he was referencing a movie that he made. That's wild. but yeah, so I wanted to throw that in there because I thought that was pretty cool. So that's Valerian. I have two more movies I want to talk about. And this is the best of the bunch. War for the Planet of the Apes, Mike. Have you gotten a chance to see this yet?
I have not, actually. Oh, no. Man.
So I am a huge fan of the Planet of the Apes franchise. The original Planet of the Apes, one of my favorite movies of all time. And I love these rebooted movies. I did not expect much from them when they first started. You know, when Rise of the Planet of the Apes came out, I remember seeing trailers for it and being like, yeah, I don't know. It kind of looks like, it looked kind of lame. I remember from the trailers, like, it just looked like, okay, rebooted apes, whatever. And I ended up seeing it and loved it. And Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, arguably even better. Like, it really brought that series to new heights and, like, matured the storytelling in a lot of interesting ways. War of the Planet of the Apes brings back director Matt Reeves from Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and this is a terrific conclusion to what I think is one of the great modern film series. This is, like, I think going, if you are talking about the great trilogies in cinema history, I feel like this might have to be in the conversation. These rebooted Planet of the Apes movies. I think they're kind of remarkable. You know, I loved Rise. I loved Dawn even more. And War just really sticks the landing. It's not the movie that I thought it was going to be. You know, when you hear the words War for the Planet of the Apes, you're expecting an all-out war film.
Right.
And that's kind of what Dawn promised at the end of that movie. And this isn't that. It's more like a mix of Apocalypse Now meets The Great Escape, where it's, you know, it's a war film, but it's a much quieter and more subversive and more interesting movie than I think what an all-out war movie would have been. So it's right. Both of those movies, but with apes thrown in the mix. I do think it's weird that both of the ape movies this year, War of the Planet of the Apes and Kong Skull Island, directly reference Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
And draw heavily on Vietnam imagery. But yeah, anyway, War of the Planet of the Apes, just incredible. Dude, give Andy Serkis every Oscar.
Like, he's got to get one.
He has to. This is the role of his career. And that is a career that includes Gollum. You know, like, that's right.
Yeah.
I really think this is like his best work in these Planet of the Apes movies. And, you know, by the time this movie ends, like, you're just so enthralled and so, like, you feel like you've been through so much with this character because you have. Like, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, you watched him grow up. And then in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, you see him in like a pivotal moment in apes history. And then in this movie, you really see him in this, like, really intense situation, and it's just so, so good. Cannot recommend War of the Planet of the Apes highly enough, especially if you like the first two. So definitely wanted to talk about that. And then I have one last one to talk about, Mike, and then we can move on to our review. The movie I want to talk about now is Okja, which is the new film from director Bong Joon-ho, and it's a Netflix original movie. And this is one of the most wonderfully unique and original movies that I've seen all year. I mean, it is just kind of insane that anybody funded this. Like, I remember Bong Joon-ho was the director of Snowpiercer. He also directed a great movie called The Host back in 2006, which is it's a great Korean monster movie that's really great. But Snowpiercer came out in 2013, and I remember there was a whole lot of stuff going on surrounding the release of Snowpiercer because Harvey Weinstein, who was releasing the movie, wanted to significantly edit the movie down and, like, cut out a bunch of stuff and, like, really alter what the movie was. And Bong Joon-ho was fighting it for so long, and eventually it got released untouched. Like, Bong Joon-ho's vision was thrown in there. But, like, after that, it was kind of unclear about what the future of Bong Joon-ho's movies would be like, if he would have to succumb to studio whims or whatever. And luckily Netflix came along and was just like, we'll give you like $100 million and you can just go nuts and
just do whatever.
It's great. So, this movie's about so many things. It's kind of hard to pin down. And to that end, like, it's not always successful in what it's doing, but I think it's just so crazy to watch. It's so much fun. I think it's very funny. It's very sad. It feels like something that only Netflix would ever give money to, and for that, I'm grateful. There are terrific action sequences in this movie, and there's also, like, really biting social commentary. Totally out there performances from Tilda Swinton and Jake Gyllenhaal. Jake Gyllenhaal, in particular, just goes for it. He is incredible. This is, like, the campiest I've ever seen Jake Gyllenhaal be. Wow. And it's kind of nuts. I really, like, if you were on the fence about watching Okja, watch it for Jake Gyllenhaal and just see, like, how insane he's going in this movie. He's putting on this, it feels like a role that Nicolas Cage might take.
Okay. Yep. I got it already.
If that doesn't sell you, I don't know what does. But yeah, so I had, like, next to no idea what the movie was about beforehand, other than that it involved a creature named Okja. And I would recommend just going in, like, blind like that, just to let it unfold. It is pretty wild. So I wanted to bring up Okja, and that wraps up my discussions, Mike. So now we can finally move on to our featured review of Dunkirk.
The call went out. We have to go to Dunkirk. Ready on the stern line.
What are you doing? You know where we're going.
Into war, George.
I'll be useful, sir.
One of ours. He's on me.
I'm on him.
The ship's about to leave.
They need to send more ships. Every hour, the enemy pushes closer. They've activated the civilian boats.
Civilians? We need destroyers.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk!
I'm not going back.
We know they will die.
You're weekend sailors, not the bloody Navy.
Should be at home.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
All right, that was from the trailer for Dunkirk, the new movie written and directed by Christopher Nolan. The movie stars Fionn Whitehead, Kenneth Branagh, Cillian Murphy, Mark Rylance, Tom Hardy, James Darcy, and Harry Styles, among others. And I forgot to write down the IMDb plot synopsis, but I'll just throw one out there. It's about the evacuation of British soldiers from Dunkirk in World War II. Is that good enough? Did I get it?
That might be too many details. I don't know. For an IMDb synopsis.
That's true. I should have cut it out by like six words. but yeah. Also, I wanted to throw this out there. There's some press going around before the movie that Harry Styles from One Direction is in this movie. And as I watched the movie, I realized that I don't know what Harry Styles looks like. So I...
Wow. I had no idea. Lucky.
I had no idea which one. I thought he was the main character, and then it turned out he was not.
Nope. That wasn't him.
But, yeah, so I wanted to just throw that out there that I am out of touch with the youth of today. But
no, Mike, they're out of touch with you.
That's exactly right, Mike. See, you get it. That's why we have the podcast together. all right, so I'm a pretty massive Christopher Nolan fan right here. I've seen everything he's done. And I don't think he's ever made a film I thought that was less than good, you know, and, many of his films, Memento, The Prestige, Dark Knight, Inception, Interstellar, could all conceivably be contenders to rank among my favorite films of all time. Like, I think they're just I love them so much. They're that good. Mike, I mean, what's your background with Christopher Nolan? Like, what do you take away from his movies a lot of the time?
Yeah, I agree with those things you said. I remember knowing him from Dark Knight and, you know, the Batman movies, and then taking, I think it was an independent cinema class in college, and we watched Following.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck? And then I have proceeded to watch all of his movies from, yep. and he's definitely in my favorite directors of all time. Even Interstellar. I love Interstellar.
I love the hell out of Interstellar. I've seen some more love for Interstellar recently, which I like. I remember when that movie came out, people were trashing it.
It was very...
It was a very divisive movie, and I think because that movie is so sincere, and that's something that frightens people. They are afraid of feeling emotions sometimes. But yeah, so I also love Interstellar too. But I was looking forward to Dunkirk, and I know you were too.
Yeah.
And I found this to be a very harrowing experience. Like, Dunkirk was really intense. You know, there's a lot to admire about it. I think very few movies are this well-paced, this well-shot, that fucking sound this good. Like, the sound in this movie, Mike, so good.
Yeah, so. Every detail is – I don't even know how to put it, Mike.
Yeah, but I did also feel while I was watching it that I was sort of watching it at a remove almost. Like, I feel like, you know, Nolan has been criticized in the past for his films being emotionally distant. You know, he's very, like, cold filmmaker in some respects. And that's never been a problem for me. For me, that's always, like, a feature of his movies and not a bug. But for some reason, like, I felt that here. And I think that's – I think part of that is a little bit of initial confusion for me when it starts, because there's this time jumping thing early on that is not super clear about what's happening. At least I felt that way. Like, it starts off and it says the mole 1 week or something, like the mole 1 week. And you don't even know what the mole is at that point. So you're just like, okay. And then it cuts to the next scene. And it's like the air, like 1 day or something. And it's like the sea one. And it's like, it's just very quick. And it's like, you're trying to, so I spent kind of the first quarter of the movie trying to catch up to the pace of what the movie was doing. But that said, I really feel like that's something that would fall away if I saw the movie a second time, which I likely will. And this feels like something that I will fall in love with upon subsequent rewatches, is the thing. Usually when I watch a Nolan movie, I have this feeling of like being overwhelmed by how much I loved it. I didn't have that this time around, but it felt like I will have that eventually, is kind of what I got.
Yeah.
What was your overall take on Dunkirk, Mike?
I definitely felt that confusion with the time thing and Christopher Nolan and his nonlinear editing and time and story structure. That's like his bread and butter, basically, outside of the Batman movies, I guess.
Yeah. Even the Batman movies throw out there. Batman Begins has a lot of like flashbacks woven throughout that movie. But yeah,
that's true. Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen that one. But I was fucking in it. I had heard that it's a roughly a 2-hour panic attack, and I was like, oh, that can't be true. But from as soon as we're with, you know, we have like title cards sort of that's giving us some background information, and we go to a group of soldiers, and we're just fucking there, and we're in World War II, and the clock starts ticking literally. And that was it. I was in, holding the armrests of my chair. I was very much, tense, anxious, scared. I was confused by the time stuff, but also, I feel it's kind of hard. It's a hard thing to differentiate between intentional confusion and criticizing something for the thing it was doing on purpose. Right. But it's still a fair criticism to make that it is difficult to follow what's happening. But also the soldiers that we're with would have no idea what's happening, right? but it's still a thing that, you know, it's a very valid criticism to make. I just happened to accept it, I guess, was it worked for me. But and it did, I did have like 1 foot on the cold, emotionless side of the scale, like you mentioned, but also 1 foot enraptured in the story, because we, I think, get like 4 people's names, maybe. And there's so much going on and everyone's running around and all this stuff. It's very hard to keep track of everyone. But I was in. I love this movie.
Yeah.
And I want to see it again in glorious 70mm IMAX this time. It is beautiful in 70mm. It's gorgeous.
Nice. Yeah, obviously. I saw it in a regular movie theater and it looks great still, but I'm sure it looks way fucking better in 70mm, which is the preferred. Nolan prefers you to see it in that format. It's not always feasible for people who don't live in big cities. For those of us who live in backwards Hickville, sometimes we gotta watch it in the theater, in the regular.
Gotta suck it up.
Yeah, but still. So we should talk about some of the stuff that happened. Like, this movie essentially follows 3 different aspects of the Dunkirk conflict as they're happening. It shows the soldiers on the ground, Tom Hardy in the air, and Mark Rylance's boat on the sea. And I mean, I'm curious what you thought the strongest stuff in the film was, because to me, it was the stuff on Mark Rylance's boat. That's kind of the least tense part of the movie.
Is
the stuff with Mark Rylance's boat. But to me, that was like that to me felt like a character I could connect to, as opposed to maybe everybody else who you're kind of just about the conflict, and that felt like you're getting sort of an audience surrogate in Mark Rylance's character, sort of.
Yeah, it's definitely the like philosophical backbone of the film, that storyline.
Right, which Nolan also loves to throw into a lot of his movies too.
Yeah, I'm torn. I loved all three of them. It's like picking a favorite child. But I think that one is that storyline on the sea had the most, as I said, philosophical and emotional impact. I think the story on the beach was more gripping, I think, if that's the right word.
Right.
I was more invested in those characters. It split up the things that I want in a movie to happen in one arc, but it splits them into three, right? Like the gripping and exciting tense stuff is the beach. The emotional and philosophical backbone is the boat, and the air is kind of like just the action movie part. Even though the air stuff is also tense and gripping.
Yeah, and really cool. And Tom Hardy is just incredible. Once again, acting through a mask.
I mean, he could do it.
Yeah, I have become convinced that he hates his own face. Like it's the only logical explanation. But yeah, I do think like the non-officer soldiers in the movie, they all kind of look the same. And so it's sometimes difficult to tell them apart, but this also, I think, isn't a story that's for the most part meant to get you like really in depth with the characters. You're kind of just supposed to be intense with the situation. And I think
Nolan, you're supposed to experience it.
Exactly. It's kind of the experience. And Nolan, I think, seems most fascinated with the way the conflict works. I think he's a director that has always been fascinated by procedure, like the how and why of something that happens. And I think that's what this movie really excels at and what it really kind of does. That's basically the whole movie. It's why he spends so much time explaining the rules of Inception in that movie, or, you know, we see the process of Batman making the Batarangs in Batman Begins. You know, this movie indulges that impulse to the extreme, to the most part for a really good effect, I think. This movie and Interstellar, feel like Nolan, like attempting to grow as a filmmaker in different ways to me. Like Interstellar sees him tackling a much more emotional story than he usually goes for. You know, because up to that point, like Nolan's movies had been sometimes criticized as like very cold and distant, emotionless movies. And Interstellar really goes in on the emotion. Like it talks about like how love is the most powerful force in the universe and all that stuff. And
it's the fifth element, Mike.
Exactly. and this kind of doesn't really do the emotional stuff as much, but it does kind of get rid of the more complicated stuff that his films usually do. Like the other kind of big criticism for Nolan's films a lot of the time is that they're very complicated and they're very like overly complex, some might say. I don't agree with that, but other people have criticized that in the past. And I think Dunkirk kind of eschews a lot of the more complicated ideas that his films usually hang on to, despite the time-jumping thing that you kind of have to get used to at the beginning, to deliver a pretty tight and intense thriller. Like his movies are usually really long. His movies tend to, like his last two movies are Interstellar and Dark Knight Rises. Both of them are over 2.5 hours. This one is 1 hour and 47 minutes. And I think, you know, it just flies by. Like it's so perfectly paced and there's not like a wasted moment in this movie. And I think that's to its effects.
Yeah. I remember walking out of the theater and looking at my phone and seeing what time it was and feeling like that was the longest 1 hour and 45 minutes in like the best way. I felt like I was in that theater for 4 fucking hours on that beat. Like that's how into this, like I invested and tense I was coming out of this movie.
You had been in the shit.
And I was back in the world now. but like much to its credit, I was like, it's a impressive feat to have that effect on an audience member, I think.
It's
such a short amount of time.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we'll talk about some of the actors in this movie. Tom Hardy, we already mentioned, is doing great work. I've heard a lot of people really praise Kenneth Branagh in this movie, and he's good. He's really good. But I feel like his character is like, I don't know, I feel like he doesn't really do that much in the movie other than, like, stand there.
I was going to say that it's a really interesting thing. Like, no one's kind of really doing anything in this movie, right? And I don't mean that in like they are kind of, most of it, they're standing around, I guess. Right. Like that's what's going on. But so it's really weird. And you know, like you said, the film and story doesn't focus on the characters a whole lot. It focuses on the situation and the event and the experience.
Because essentially the plot of the movie is a bunch of soldiers on a beach standing there trying not to die.
yeah, waiting for a boat. Like, yeah.
Like that's essentially what the movie boils down to.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, but it, somehow they, like, managed to wring a lot of intensity out of that premise, and I think it's really cool. But, yeah, I mean, Kenneth Branagh is good in the movie, and everybody is good in the movie. Like, everybody is doing really great work. And I've heard a lot of people, like, really praise Kenneth Branagh and say, like, oh, he could be nominated for an Oscar, and it's like, I don't really see that. But for me, Mark Rylance, man, is the movie's MVP. I think he was phenomenal in this movie. And I think my favorite, like, find of an actor over the past couple of years. Is Mark Rylance. Like we talked about Bridge of Spies, and that movie came out, and I think he's incredible in that movie. He was amazing in the BFG as the BFG. And now he's in this movie, and he's popping up again in Ready Player One next year. Basically, he's going to be in every Spielberg movie from now until the end of time.
Why not?
Yeah, because he's great. But yeah, Mark Rylance is great in this movie. Also, Cillian Murphy is great in this movie, too. Again, the stuff on the boat was kind of my favorite stuff in the movie, and so maybe I'm biased, but I think they were both really great.
Yeah, yeah, I think Cillian Murphy did great. I think the group of soldiers on the beach that we kind of follow, they're all amazing. I don't know, what was his name? Fionn Whitehead, right?
Yeah, something like that. Fionn Whitehead.
Fionn Whitehead, the like kind of main dude.
Yeah.
He doesn't even have a name in the credit, which is amazing, I think, if I remember right.
Right.
He did a great job. Harry Styles in his limited role, right? He's in a kind of supporting role. He does a really good job. The French guy, he has no character. I think his name, or he has no name. It was like French soldier.
French soldier, yeah.
He's amazing, I think. And I love that kind of group of soldiers that is sort of like, yeah, I don't want to say getting the band together, right? That's got the wrong emotional implication, I think, for how they get together. But it's kind of these dudes that just happen to follow each other, sort of, in the situation. And I kind of love that. That was really interesting how they kind of all come together as a, you know, just from standing on a beach trying not to die to actively working together.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now, we've talked a lot about the actors in this movie, Mike, but the real star of this movie is Hans fucking Zimmer.
Oh my God.
Whose score for this movie is just unreal. You know, I think that's where a lot of the intensity comes from, is just because you're listening to Hans Zimmer's score throughout this movie. Like, it's incredible. It perfectly captures the tension of each moment. I think it's some of the best work of his career. And that ticking clock that you referenced earlier, that's going to become iconic, I think. That's going to be like another...
It's the Bwom from Inception.
It's the new Bwom. I really think Hans Zimmer does a lot of his best work with Nolan. Like, I mean, the Dark Knight score is incredible, and the Inception score is incredible. This is another thing that will become the new Bwom, or the new Joker theme in the Dark Knight, with that weird like mandolin thing that's like playing that really long one note for like 45 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to be the next that. So I think that's pretty cool. And going back, like, working from that, the sound design of this movie we mentioned before is just bananas good. Like, it's so good. I jumped like 7 or 8 times just from the sound of like the incredibly sudden gunfire that happened in the movie, because it's so much. And I saw it in like a regular theater. I can't imagine what it was like on a 70mm screening.
Yeah.
I would probably piss myself.
And there's a, you know, there is so much to be said for the use of silence, right? There's a couple moments where things just get quiet and the tension where you know, going from a literal ticking clock to suddenly it's just, there's nothing. The tension that somehow gets added on top of listening to a countdown, basically, right? Of something you think, is amazing. Yeah. The sound design. Hopefully this wins all the Oscars.
I'm sure. I feel like it will be like a pretty big Oscar contender, this year. Cause it's a pretty popular movie, first of all.
Yeah,
and everyone gets
a bajillion dollars.
Yeah, and so the Academy usually likes to throw in a popular movie if they can, and this will. I think this is like the easiest contender for a popular movie being thrown in there. You know, I feel like this is the most Oscar friendly movie as far as mainstream movies go, that we're gonna have all year. Because as much as I would love to believe it, War for the Planet of the Apes is not going to get a ton of love at the Oscars. I'm sure it'll get like a visual effects nomination, but otherwise, yeah. Or like Baby Driver is not going to get a ton of love at the Oscars.
Suicide Squad 2 will win, Mike, not War for the Planet of the Apes.
Hey, Suicide Squad won an Oscar. Anything can happen. Remember, best makeup went to Suicide Squad for writing the word damage on the Joker's forehead. But yeah, so I do think this will be kind of a big contender at the Oscars this year. And so I think like, it could be Nolan's like I think it could win. Like it's like obviously we're so far removed from that. Like it's 6 months out. Like who knows what could happen between now and then. But like I feel like Nolan is such a huge name director at this point, and I feel like the Oscars would want that kind of publicity. And I feel like you know that this could be the year of Nolan in terms of the Oscars. I know,
yeah,
like they nominated Inception when that came out for Best Picture. And that was a surprise. But I remember like the reason they have 10, like Nolan is the reason they have a 10 Best Picture nominees. I don't know if you know that. But the reason we have 10 Best Picture nominees instead of 5 now is because in the year 2008, there were 5 nominees and The Dark Knight wasn't nominated. and people got very upset. So the next year they expanded to 10 nominees, like the next year, because The Dark Knight wasn't nominated because of Christopher Nolan. I believe Wally was also a movie where I was like, hey, why wasn't Wally nominated? But I feel like The Dark Knight was bigger. Because of Christopher Nolan, we now have 10 movie categories for Best Picture at the Oscars. And then Inception was nominated for Best Picture. And then I very much doubt Dark Knight Rises had a ton of stuff there. I don't think Interstellar had a ton of love at the Oscars except for like visual and sound effects and stuff. But still, I think this could be the year of Nolan at the Oscars if that comes to pass. And I don't mean to project Oscar predictions 6 months out, because who knows
what could July.
Yeah, in July. But who knows what could happen. But still, I do really think this is a really strong movie. I don't think it's I don't think it's among my favorite Nolan movies, but like, you know, that's saying, you know, is this among my top 200 movies of all time? Like, who knows? Because a lot of Nolan movies are, you know, so it's like,
yeah, exactly.
It's tough to make that call, but yeah. So should we move on to spoilers for Dunkirk, Mike?
Yes, I think we should.
Okay, let's do that. Let's move on to spoilers for Dunkirk, starting right now. All right, spoilers for Dunkirk, starting right now. So I mentioned before, I thought the best stuff in the movie was the stuff on the boat with Mark Rylance and Cillian Murphy. Like, Rylance is a civilian in this movie, volunteering to help evacuate these soldiers. I think that's just a great character, and there's a lot of great stuff to explore in that. And Cillian Murphy is a shell-shocked soldier. who that's a tongue twister, does not want to go back to Dunkirk, and it creates some great tension and results in probably the movie's most heartbreaking death. It's not even a soldier. It's a young kid who just wanted to be a part of something, and I think that's that's the movie's emotional climax, I think, right there, is when that kid dies. When Cillian Murphy like accidentally hurts that kid and like nearly kills him. And then it's like a few minutes later, the soldiers are loading onto the boat, and the other kid's like, "Hey, be careful with him! Be careful with him!" And the soldier's like, "He's dead." And it's just like such a deadpan. Like my entire theater was silent. It was really intense. So yeah, other scenes that you wanted to point out, Mike?
I think right in the beginning, you know, we have this character that's sort of, you know, survives this attack, right? And ends up on the beach that we kind of follow and kind of becomes the main character of the beach storyline, at least. And he gets in line, you know, he finds I guess I spoiled that earlier, the friend, the other guy on the beach, the friend who turns out to be fresh. So I apologize for that. But they kind of get online, right, to just wait for the boats, and the first bombing happens that we see, and there is a shot of him, you know, everyone just kind of scatters and they drop to the sand, and there is a shot looking at his face as the explosions from the bombs are just slowly getting closer and closer and closer and closer, and they just stop, and he just got lucky and he survives.
When the bombs hit that soldier that's behind, like when you from where the camera is, the camera's like facing him from the side, and there's a soldier, like, you know, you can see him in the distance behind him, and you can just see the bomb hit the soldier and just exploding everywhere, and like the soldier's ashes and like whatever's left of the soldier is falling on him. Oh man, that is that is insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. And what's kind of
that happens like 4 minutes into the movie, I think. Right? We're just in this insane tense situation immediately, and that's a scene I really liked.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we should talk about the beginning of the movie. We should talk about the end of the movie, where You could just cut the tension in my theater with a knife. The climax of this movie is really great. And I mean, just the way, like I talked about the time shifting thing before and how confusing that is, but it really comes together very satisfyingly in the end when all three storylines kind of converge. You know, and it's so good. Like all the soldiers are there, they're getting onto all the civilian boats, and Tom Hardy's in the air just taking people out. It's really great. Everyone in my theater was on edge, and everything is played like just perfectly in the movie, especially Tom Hardy taking out the last bomber. It's just such a great like yeah moment. Like it's pretty great.
Yeah, and that moment. So I did. It took me a long time to figure out what the times were, where we see the mole 1 week, the sea 1 day, the air 1 hour. That took me forever to realize that's how long each storyline covers.
Yeah.
And like, I think it took me until, you know, we see the bomber and the plane the ship sinking, and then like the carrier or the destroyer getting bombed, and like all that stuff happening from the air first,
right?
And then we go to the beach where we see that ship when the soldiers first find it, and that was the it's like three quarters into the movie by the time I figured it out. But it still was it didn't lessen the movie for me.
Yeah,
but I did really love that scene where all of those things converge. And we kind of all, in those moments, we still sort of switch storylines, right? Like we kind of spend time with the soldiers in the water. We spend time on the boat. We spend time with the pilots and like all those things happening that simultaneously, incredibly tense.
Yes, absolutely. And you mentioned all the soldiers going in the ship. The scene with all the soldiers in a ship is another great one. Just, you know, trying to keep low, avoiding random gunfire from people shooting target practice. Is just really tense. That was one of those moments that made me jump when those gunfires started coming in, and then them trying to force the one French soldier out of the group,
right?
Because they think he might like weigh them down, which is like kind of absurd considering how many soldiers there are in that in that ship. But I think that's kind of the idea, is that they're not thinking clearly because they're in this like horrible like life and death situation.
I mean, they think he's a German spy first, right?
That's true.
They accuse him of that.
Yeah, the guy accusing him is Harry Styles, which I had to research.
Right.
I researched that later. I was like, oh, that was the guy who Harry Styles was. I don't know anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the big scene, you know, where he gets to show off his acting. And I think he does a good job in that moment. You know?
Yeah, he was good.
He does a great job.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, I said this probably won't be one of my favorite Nolan movies, but I think with repeat viewing, it's going to especially like I really liked it, and I think with repeat viewing, it's going to rise in my estimation to the point where, hey, maybe it might be one of my favorite Nolan movies. Like I'm open to it,
right?
But I think it really highlights Nolan's ability to make like just terrific blockbuster entertainment on a huge scale and of high quality, like no one else is doing right now. And that's the thing. Like I think Batman has really given him the cachet to just be the guy who can do anything. Because not only were his Batman movies hits, his original movies are hits. Like they're huge movies. Like Inception was a huge hit when that came out. Like everybody was talking about that movie.
He followed up Batman with two crazy science fiction movies, right? Like Inception and Interstellar.
And The Prestige, also. I mean, that was the one that was right after Batman Begins. Every time he made a Batman movie, he followed it up with a crazy like thing.
Yeah.
It's pretty nuts. And so it's just really every Nolan movie now feels like an event. Like he feels like he's become like a real name director. And that's something that doesn't really exist to the same degree that it used to anymore. Like, you know, you have your Spielbergs and you have your Scorsese's. Those are all like holdovers from the 70s, you know?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I feel like in the 21st century, there's only like a handful of people who you can point to as like named directors, like people who don't go to the movies that often would know them, you know? And I feel like Nolan has reached that point where people know who Christopher Nolan is.
Yeah.
You know, like every trailer for this movie has like from Christopher Nolan, the director of the Dark Knight trilogy and Interstellar and stuff like that. And so like people know those movies, people saw those movies, people liked those movies. And so, Nolan really has become like, he has so much power in Hollywood now. And he's using it to make really great stuff. It's kind of great. Like how many like post 20th century name directors can you even think of? You know, like I can think of like M. Night Shyamalan, would be,
yeah.
He would be one, because he's somebody that everybody knows, but not as like he's not making movies in the quality of Nolan. And
that's what I was going to say. It's so interesting to have a director like that, that has that status, right, of everyone knows who this person is.
Yeah.
And of such a pure film caliber of Christopher Nolan.
Yes.
Like, to do what he does the way he does it, he's the only one, right. I think.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. So, really glad that Christopher Nolan is still doing his thing and still making just awesome movies, and will presumably continue to do that for the foreseeable future. There were rumors, there's always been rumors swirling around that Nolan might do a Bond movie one day, and now that they've announced Bond 25, there are rumors going around again that Nolan could possibly do it. He's not going to do a Bond movie. there's no way. We already had a Nolan Bond movie, and it was called Skyfall.
yeah, pretty much.
Which like Skyfall is.
I guess Tarantino is another one. Like,
oh yeah, Quentin Tarantino is absolutely a named director, but I feel like he's more a holdover from the 90s. Like that's where he became a named director.
I see what you're saying. Yes, so,
I'm talking about people who became a named director after the 21st century, and even M. Night Shyamalan, like The Sixth Sense, came out in '99. But I could see like you know kind of his rising profile from '99.
We'll let it slide.
Yeah,
we'll let it slide.
But yeah, I mean, post 2000, like I mean. There are directors who I love and admire, and I will go see any of their stuff. Like, you know, Edgar Wright, for example. But if you go to, like, a random person on the street, they're not going to know who Edgar Wright is. There's, you know, even though he's made, like, you know, they might have even seen, like, Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz or something, because those are immensely popular movies. But, like, people don't go see them when they're in theaters, you know? I mean, Baby Driver was a pretty big hit for Edgar Wright. But, you know, that got a lot of good reviews.
Yeah.
And it was, I feel like recently there's been kind of a shift towards, like, more original stuff doing really well at theaters, and that's exciting, too. So that's pretty cool. But, yeah, otherwise, like, I really do struggle to think of, like, people besides Nolan, Shyamalan, maybe, like, I don't know. Like, it's post-21st century, it's tough to think of somebody who has the mainstream audience in such a grip that they'll go see all their movies, you know. Michael Bay, who is also from the 90s.
Ugh, that hurts to even think about.
But like, he's also a
whole group
from the 90s, you know? He's also, like, everybody knows who Michael Bay is the thing. That's kind of the thing. Like, everybody knows who these people are. It's not even that they go see their movies every time. It's that everybody knows who they are. And I feel like Nolan is at that point, which is, you know, pretty cool. But yeah, anyway, Mike, I think that about wraps up our review of Dunkirk, unless you have more to add, or if you want to throw out some more directors that you could think of as named directors from the 21st century, which I think we could have a really good discussion about.
I think our episode has reached the runtime of the movie, so maybe we should end.
Honestly, like, you're not wrong. It's close. It's really close.
Yeah.
So, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to FilmbookCast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this view via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Help support the podcast and Filmbook by taking part in our Patreon campaign. You can find our Patreon campaign page at patreon.com/filmbook. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, and things are kind of up in the air at the moment since I'll be on vacation that week, but we're definitely going to talk about something soon, whether that's Atomic Blonde or Detroit or The Dark Tower or what have you. There's a whole bunch of stuff coming out. Logan Lucky, also a big one, that's with the big return of Steven Soderbergh. So a lot of stuff coming out, so we'll keep you posted on whatever that's going to be. And you can join us for the next episode of The Complete Works, in which we'll be discussing Nicolas Cage's role in Andrew Niccol's 2005 film Lord of War. So looking forward to that. We'll see how it goes. I am kind of mixed on the work of Andrew Niccol, but I love Gattaca. So there's that at least. He made Gattaca, if that wasn't... if you got that going for you. If you need a cut. Well, I said I love Gattaca and you laughed. I just wanted to give you context. For that. He also wrote The Truman Show, which is pretty great. So there's that as well. So,
all right.
Thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out.